Tired of sugar-coated news and corporate spin? Check out The Nicole Sandler Show, speaking truth to power with the irreverence it deserves. Smart, fearless, and just the right amount of snark, Nicole breaks down the headlines, exposes the hypocrisy, and talks with the people working for real change. Weekdays at 3 Eastern, noon Pacific on Progressive Voices, NicoleSandler.com, Substack, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't just get the news, get the truth.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein, and this is Spy Talk.
Now, David Martin on assignment for 60 Minutes.
The U.S. airstrike against Iranian-backed militias Thursday night was the latest chapter in the poisonous relationship with Iran President Biden inherited from the Trump administration. 13 months ago, the two countries came perilously close to war. It began with an American drone strike, which killed Iran's most powerful general.
Yes, that's the David Martin you've been hearing and watching on CBS for 40 years now. For four decades, Martin has been a reliable national security correspondent on shows ranging from 60 Minutes to the Evening News to CBS Sunday Morning and all the others. Martin got his introduction to the military world by serving on a Navy destroyer during the Vietnam War, followed by stints as a CBS News intern, a Newsweek researcher, and then a reporting job at the Associated Press before joining CBS in 1983. Parlaying contacts and trust he's built up over the decades, from the lowliest grunts in Iraq and Afghanistan to the starched generals and admirals at the Pentagon, Martin has been an authoritative and yet comfortably familiar figure at CBS News, relaying his scoops and even the most unsettling military news in clear and concise language that illuminates and explains, never hectors, in a news media world that has been, like the rest of America, rocked by polarization and, of course, vast technological changes. At CBS years ago, some colleagues nicknamed him Run Silent, Run Deep, for his intense solo work on telephones and quiet contact with national security officials, all of which has earned him and his longtime producer, Mary Walsh, countless scoops and several Emmys and many other elite journalism awards. David Martin has also been a groundbreaking author. The title of his 1983 book, Wilderness of Mirrors, coined a phrase that's been universally adopted to describe the often funhouse world of spies and counter-spies. That's quite an accomplishment on its own. I'm delighted to have David Martin as my Spy Talk guest this week.
David Martin, welcome to Spy Talk, and congratulations on being inducted this week into the National Television Academy Arts and Sciences Gold Circle Honor Society. That's pretty nice. What does it mean for you?
Well, you know, it's kind of bittersweet because obviously you like being recognized by your peers, but the fact that I'm getting a medal which says the number 50 on it tells you that the calendar does not lie. And, you know, I hate to think of having to leave this business. I enjoy it so much, but, you know, we're coming down to it.
Well, you're still going strong. I'm sure you've been asked many times in the last couple of decades, well, why don't you quit? I mean, you're fully vested in your pension and so on. You've been with CBS for some, what, 40 years now?
40 and- years, yeah. well, I'll tell you what happens is you, you know, you come to the end of another contract, and you have to make a decision then whether you want to sign yep. on for basically three more years. And it always seems to happen that just when that crunch time for a decision is coming, I fall into an especially interesting story. And I say to myself, wait a minute, they're paying you to do this. You'd be a right. fool to walk away.
I do think that to myself some days. I say, boy, Gee, I'm getting, oh, I'm paying myself now. I'm in on my own at Substack. But I'm getting paid to do this. This is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So you've had a long and very distinguished career, obviously, and I want to get back to some of the highlights of that. But we have something in common in terms of our origin stories, you might say. We're both Vietnam era veterans. Yeah. I was an Army intelligence case officer in Vietnam during the war. You were in the Navy. What did you do there? And can we assume that, like me, your career as a national security reporter, an investigative reporter at that, originated with your Navy service during Vietnam?
Yeah, you can assume that. So I went, after I graduated, I bummed around for a while. I graduated in 1965, which, of course, is when the war ramped up. So if I had just waited, the Army would have come and drafted me. I decided to go into the Navy, go to Officer Candidate School, and then I got assigned to a destroyer in Pearl Harbor, which spent at least half of the 3 years I was in, close to half of the 3 years I was in the Gulf of Tonkin, either doing plane guard for the carriers, waiting for a pilot who had to eject and picking them up, or doing shore bombardment runs up and down the coast of Vietnam, both both south and north. You know, I'm not sure we made much of a difference in the war, but it was an experience that really changed the direction of my life. When I went to college, I had no idea of a career in journalism, and the thought of having anything to do with the military had occurred to me long enough to be rejected out of hand. And then along comes Vietnam, I got out in 1969, so I was kind of making up my mind, okay, what do I want to do with the rest of my life? During 1968 and 1969, and of course 1968 was one of the most unforgettable news years in our history, with the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy, the Tet Offensive, the riot that was the Chicago Democratic Convention. And after the year was over, CBS put out a long-playing record, just recapping the events of 1968. And I bought that record, and I listened to that over and over. I probably listened to that as much as I listened to Sergeant Pepper, and I was hooked. I was just hooked on the drama of those events of 1968, and wanted to be in a position where I could cover them.
And you first went to Newsweek.
Well, actually, my very first job was as a researcher for CBS News.
Right, right.
And I did, I think, a year and a half there. And that was long enough for me to realize that I was never going to become a reporter from being a researcher. They're just not going to let you learn on their airtime.
Yeah.
So then I went away, learned how to be a reporter. First at the Associated Press, which I count as the most valuable experience of my life, because it just really taught you the basics. Get it first, but first get it right. And it just, I'm convinced that all the habits I learned in my 20s are the habits I've used ever since.
Yeah, I think Hunter Gonzo Thompson said much the same.
Yeah.
When he was writing his hallucinatory prose for Rolling Stone, that it all began with the Associated Press.
It's a terrific news organization.
The five W's, who, what, why, where, when.
in 25 words or less.
In 25. But you naturally drifted into national security reporting, I guess.
Well, it was the only expertise I had. Of course, you and I both know that the expertise you get as a junior officer on a single destroyer is very, very limited. I could tell you a lot about one destroyer in the United States Navy, but I couldn't tell you a hell of a lot about national security. But it was the only thing I had to market myself with, and I was lucky enough to catch on there at CBS, and I got that first job as a researcher because a guy named Howard Stringer, who had been a researcher, had just gotten his first promotion. Howard went on and kept getting promoted until he was the first the executive producer of the Evening News, then the president of CBS News. And when he was running the Evening News, that's when I got hired a second time by CBS.
Okay.
And I came back as sort of his project, which gave me a lot of leeway to fail.
Early on in your career, or pretty early on in your career, you tackled an immense subject, an immense and complicated subject, which turned into the book Wilderness of Mirrors, which coined a term for generations to come. Tell us, and that was the behind-the-scenes account of the, I'm reading from the copy online now, behind-the-scenes account of the post-war struggle between the CIA and the KGB, which focused on William Harvey, Covert Operations Ace, and James Jesus Angleton, Master of Counterintelligence. It's been a monumental book, very influential beyond the intelligence realm. How did you get onto that story, and why did you tackle it in a book?
As a reporter for the Associated Press, I was covering the Church Committee hearings, which were the hearings chaired by Senator Frank Church into all the alleged misdeeds of the CIA during the Cold War. And one of those misdeeds was the assassination plot to kill Fidel Castro. And one of the people who had run it was this former FBI agent turned CIA officer named Bill Harvey. And I heard the story that he had been touted to President Kennedy as America's 007. And so the president wanted to meet him, and so they took him to the Oval Office. And while they were waiting outside the Oval Office to be called in, the person who was escorting him suddenly realized that Harvey was packing. He liked to carry weapons, even though he was working in a relatively safe job at CIA headquarters. And it was just part of his moxie to carry a weapon. So they had to disarm him before before they took him in to meet the president. And I think I've never seen anything in any of the archives about the president's reaction to America's 007. Remember, he was a great fan of the Ian Fleming novels. Uh-huh. So when somebody tells him, here's our American 007, he must have really perked up. But
but he didn't look anything like Sean Connery. No, or
there was not even a coincidental resemblance. I mean, he was pear-shaped and bug-eyed. But you know, he had done some fairly impressive operations, particularly when he was the chief of the Berlin operation in the 1950s. He was the guy who oversaw this massive project in which the CIA tunneled from West Berlin into East Berlin and tapped into the major Soviet telephone exchange. Mm-hmm. So there was this period of time where they had direct access to all the Soviet communications coming from Moscow into Berlin.
And yet...
Yes, and yet the wilderness enters because the project was compromised from the very beginning.
From the very beginning, the Soviets were listening, knew what the CIA was doing.
And then that raises the question, does that mean everything the CIA picked up on those phone taps was disinformation? Mm-hmm. Or does it mean that the Russians decided to let the operation proceed? Because, of course, if they broke it up as soon as it got started, then they would jeopardize their agent who was telling them all about it. And mm-hmm. it's one of the many lessons you learn about the wilderness,
yeah.
Which is that having a spy in a very sensitive place who is giving you golden information does not always immediately translate into golden action, because if once you act on his intelligence, you of course are raising the chance that he will be discovered, because something mm-hmm. has gone wrong. Intelligence agencies are going to try to figure out what went wrong, and
Speaking of which,
when you know, suspicions get raised.
And the guy, the other half of your book, you might say, concentrates on the man who got lost in that wilderness of mirrors, James Jesus Angleton. I think most listeners here know who he was, but in a thumbnail, he was the legendary or notorious, depending on your point of view. And it's still unsettled among many CIA veterans, as you know, whether he was brilliant or paranoid and psychotic. He was the legendary head of CIA counterintelligence and began to suspect everyone of being a Soviet mole.
I would call him brilliant and paranoid mm-hmm. because he developed this theory that there was a mole inside the CIA, and that mole was compromising the identity of every single agent the CIA had inside the Soviet Union. Therefore, any agent that was giving the CIA information must be giving it disinformation. So it just tied the CIA in utter knots, not trusting its most valuable agents, which by the way, included probably the most famous CIA agent of all, Oleg Penkovsky.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, trying to hunt for this mole. And the way you hunt for this mole is you focus in on individual officers who had access to the identities of these agents. And once an officer fell under suspicion, he had to be transferred to some non-entity job where he could no longer do any harm if, in fact, he was the mole. And, of course, these investigations just go on for years and years. So there were a number of up-and-coming officers who fell off the fast track because they came under Angleton's suspicious eye. And later on, Congress actually passed a law appropriating money to repay some of these officers for all of the income that they had lost out on as a result of being suspected of being a mole.
It was quite a thing for you. You were still pretty young at that point, and not having that much experience under your belt to say, I've got a book in that. But still, you did and came up with, as I said, a monumental product in the book, The Wilderness of Mirrors. Some former CIA officers talk about the clandestine mentality. This is a world in its own. People who worked in operations in CIA, as you know, especially counterintelligence, were there any big surprises for you when you undertook this project?
Well, it was all an education to me. You know, I, for instance, what I knew about Soviet espionage really was the names Julius and Ethel Rosenberg.
And the atomic spies.
The atomic spies. And like everybody else, I thought there was good reason to think that they had just been railroaded and weren't spies at all. But then you get into this Soviet spy network that existed in the United States in the 1940s. And the way I got into it and the way the CIA and FBI got into it was through the existence of a program called Venona. Venona is a non-word. It doesn't mean anything, but it was the code name given to the breaking of the KGB code in 1944. The KGB used what was in theory an unbreakable code. It's called a one-time pad. And if I tried to explain it, I would probably confuse both myself and your listeners. But basically, it is a system that produces a truly random sequence of numbers, which is very, very hard to do. If I were to ask you to reel off a million numbers, sooner or later, you would fall into a pattern.
Well,
use more sevens than nines. Use two-thirds even numbers, whatever.
And yeah, we used to do it by hand.
Well, so did the KGB on this on their one-time pad. This was just an enormously labor-intensive project for them, and that's in the end what caught them up, because using that one-time pad system during the crush of communications that went on during World War II, they just couldn't keep up with turning out new one-time pads. And so they reused some of the pads.
Yep.
And
we picked up on that.
They picked up on it, and this brilliant cryptographer named Meredith Gardner started breaking into these messages. The very first message he broke into was the KGB station in Washington trying to explain to Moscow how Franklin Roosevelt might win the popular vote in the 1944 presidential election, but still lose the Electoral College and therefore lose the presidency. The second one he broke into was about a project which the KGB had codenamed Enormous, which is the perfect name for what the project really was, because it was the Manhattan Project to build the atom bomb. And that message included a list of scientists believed to be associated with Enormous, with the Manhattan Project. And from there, Meredith Gardner just kept cracking into one message after another. He'd never be able to break the whole message, but he'd always get these bits and pieces that were enough, gave the FBI enough clues to go looking for the spy. And that's what led them to Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. It's what led them to Klaus Fuchs, who was probably the most damaging spy, because he was just giving the Russians everything he could get his hands on. And all those cases that, you know, finally came to light in the 1950s, and then which remained so controversial during the 60s and 70s, were based on that original code break by what was then called the Armed Forces Security Agency, what is today the National Security Agency.
Yeah. Code breaking and intercepts are still, or even more so, a critical element of intelligence gathering today. Witness our intercepts of Russian intelligence predicting the invasion of Ukraine and so on and so forth. But I want to circle back for a moment because we've just learned of the death of Dianne Feinstein, the former chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, who, among other things, helmed the committee's investigation into CIA black sites and torture. I wonder what you think of that whole embroil, that which really divided not only Americans, but the CIA community as well, about the usefulness or efficacy or the morality of torture. What's your take on all that? And maybe a note on Feinstein herself, who you covered.
I'm glad you asked that, because I've just by coincidence been doing a lot of reading recently about the American POW experience during the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. And for those who are not old enough to remember, the American pilots who were shot down over North Vietnam were not given prisoner of war status. They were declared to be war criminals and would be treated as such. And that treatment included torture to extract confessions and propaganda statements mm-hmm. from them. And all of the POWs who survived will to this day take great relish in all the lies they told the North Vietnamese while as a result of having it tortured out of them. You know, fast forward to 9/11, and we start capturing members of Al-Qaeda. And what do? We say they're not prisoners of war. We say they're unlawful combatants.
Yeah.
And we're going to put them in Guantanamo, but first we're going to put them in these black sites, and we're going to torture information out of them. They don't use the word torture, but I think any.
Yeah. Enhanced interrogation.
Yeah, but anybody listening to what happened would call it torture.
In fact, just quick insertion here, I read a book about the Doolittle Raiders and what happened to them. You know, many survived the landing in China after they bombed Tokyo, and they were tortured and waterboarded in particular. And the Japanese who carried that out were tried as war criminals after the war for that very practice that many in CIA maintains was not torture. What, in fact, we prosecuted Japanese for war crimes as torture.
Well, that's the old line about victor's justice, right?
Mm-hmm, for sure.
But to me, you just can't escape the analogy. And, you know, we accused the North Vietnamese of being barbarians in the way they treated the American POWs. But I think we just lost all of our moral standing by the way we treated those Al-Qaeda captives. And then, of course, comes the great debate about whether they got anything useful out of them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's really hard to make a decision about that. People I respect, like Mike Hayden, former CIA director when all this was going on, have said we got valuable information out of them, and there's even a trail, they say, came out of those interrogations that was the beginning of success in the hunt for bin Laden. But there were other people on the Hill, I think of Carl Levin in particular, who said the enhanced interrogation produced no valuable intelligence, period. And, you know, Dianne Feinstein's greatest contribution to this field was to get all of these investigations into the black sites released so people could make up their own minds.
Well, only a sliver of the final report has been released, and that's a pretty big sliver.
It is.
Because the full report is, what, some 6,000 pages or so? And one administration after the other has sat on it and refused to release the full report. And it's said that the full report will show pretty persuasively that torture was not overall an effect, was not very effective, useful, that many CIA officers themselves objected to the torture and the black sites and everything that was going on there. I will note that Hayden once said to me in an interview, this General Hayden, former CIA director, said to me in an interview, we'll never get into that again. It's just too much. In the end, it was too much trouble.
Never say never, right?
That's right.
A country gets attacked, it gets its blood up, and all sorts of things happen.
What's animating you today, David, for stories and beats? What's the most interesting thing you're seeing right now? Is it the departure of Milley and the attacks on him by Trump, or what's going on in your beat it's really interesting you?
Well, of course, General Milley officially retired today, so we're going to start a new cycle with a new chairman, General C.Q. Brown, and I think that extraordinary chapter in which you had the president's principal military advisor so completely at odds with the president, with his commander in chief, it was just not a good thing for the country. And depending on which side of the political divide you are on, you can take a side. But whichever side you take, it was not a good thing for the country. But that is not what I pursue on a daily basis, particularly now that Milley is retired. I think the thing that drives me more than anything is the war in Ukraine, which is just one of the most extraordinary things. You know, if I thought in 1989 and 1990, when the Cold War ended, that you know, the Pentagon correspondent's job might become a backwater, and of course, it's become anything but. And you keep getting presented with these you couldn't have imagined scenarios. I mean, who in 1989 could have imagined that the U.S. would invade Iraq? Who in 1989 could have imagined that the U.S. would invade Afghanistan? Who in 1989 could have imagined that Russia would invade Ukraine? But it's all happened.
Yeah, a ground war in Europe. It's still astonishes people of our age, that's for sure. Thought that would never happen again. I mean, that's been confined to war movies we've been watching for decades, and now I still have to slap myself. My God, tank wars in Europe,
and I still don't think we fully appreciate the brutality of this war. Those casualty figures are just stunning. If you add up both sides, over 500,000 young men killed or wounded in the course of, what, a year and a half. That is just medieval.
And what an anachronism in this age of artificial intelligence and ICBMs and crypto war and so on. And here we are with trench warfare, like World War I, like 100 years ago, bloody, hand-to-hand, horrible kind of stuff. All of it is just mind-blowing to me and to you, too, I think. So Well, David, 40 years isn't enough for you. You're going to keep going like I am. I noted in a story the other day that inside the building, they nicknamed you Run Silent, Run Deep.
Yeah.
Because of your style of working. You just head down, pick up the phone, or go see somebody, wander around the Pentagon, accidentally on purpose, bump into some official who you know and wheedle some secret out of him. And I wish you good luck in continuing to do that. I'm a big fan of your work. I've been watching it for years, and thanks for coming on the show.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And that's it for this week's edition of Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive at the MSW Network or on Apple or Amazon or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, please check out the Spy Talk news site on Substack, where our deeply experienced contributing writers offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast, like all the others, was smoothly produced by Kanai at MSW Media with expert editing from Molly Hawkey. And that's it. Thanks for listening. I'm Jeff Stein.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Tired of sugar-coated news and corporate spin? Check out The Nicole Sandler Show, speaking truth to power with the irreverence it deserves. Smart, fearless, and just the right amount of snark. Nicole breaks down the headlines, exposes the hypocrisy, and talks with the people working for real change. Weekdays at 3 Eastern, noon Pacific on Progressive Voices, NicoleSandler.com, Substack, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't just get the news, get the truth.